Chapter 20. After departing Anshun, the Conway and her sister scout ships, the St. Asaph and the Langhorn, took a mere 72 days to reach Dyson Alpha. Commander Wilson Keim was thankful for the shortened flight time. For all her speed, the Conway was barely half the size of the Second Chance, with a corresponding shortage of crew facilities. The most obvious change was the lack of a life support wheel. The new scout ship Mark had a crew of 25, whose quarters were integrated with the main fuselage. Although the Conway superstructure was still a basic cylinder, blunt at both ends, she was a lot more streamlined than her pioneering predecessor, measuring a good 250 meters in length and 80 in diameter. The reduction in both length and volume was mainly due to reducing the plasma rockets to 3, along with all the associated cryogenic tankage. Also, given the mission profile, there was no requirement for the auxiliary craft, their hangars, and their support systems. Keim had known CST was designing second-generation starships before the Second Chance departed, but even he'd been surprised by the 7-month assembly time. More impressive was the way they'd stuck to the completion deadline with all the chaos of facilities and personnel being transferred to the High Angel. He'd still not got over his anger at that particular act of stupidity. After 3.5 centuries, he'd assumed government had by now learned how to keep bureaucratic interference to a minimum on big projects. Of course he knew it was all down to horse trading between the grand families and the intersolar dynasties. After all, he'd taken part in enough sessions and deals himself. But surely the executive knew it had to protect a project as important as this one from petty maneuverings and pork-barrel politics. Apparently not. It didn't help his temper when he found out the scale of the alliance Nigel Sheldon had formed with the Farndale board, with himself as the figurehead of cooperation. So after being perfectly outmaneuvered by committee and bumped upstairs to commander of the new Starflight Agency, there was nothing left for him except bitching to Oscar and Anna about losing crucial people at critical times because they were needed to establish a duplicate facility at High Angel. His own involvement with the new shipyards was limited to a few administrative visits and one formal reception with the redoubtable chairwoman Gall. They'd never liked each other. The reception hadn't changed that. As before, he'd devoted his time and talent to pushing the construction of the scout ships. The development of High Angel and running the Starflight Agency could wait until his return. Unlike the Commonwealth executive, he realized their absolute priority was to find out what was happening at Dyson Alpha since the barrier went down. At least his new, prestigious position meant he could give himself command of the scoutship reconnaissance mission. So now he was enduring the physical and unfortunately biological discomforts of prolonged freefall once again. The scaling down of crew quarters had included the loss of the more luxurious fittings they'd enjoyed on the first flight. Conway's compartments were a cluster of connected spheres, wrapped around the fuselage axis, behind the sensor bay and above the power deck. Each sphere had padded walls, and all the internal equipment had soft, rounded plastic edges, alleviating the worst impact bruises. But just like his time back on Ulysses, he spent hours a day on various pieces of ingenious gym equipment to prevent his heart and muscles from atrophying. Once a week he visited the doctor for his organ functions to be monitored, resulting in an assortment of biochemicals being administered to counter their decay. Then there were the mealtimes, when he had to force himself to consume the designated mass of food when he wasn't remotely hungry. And all day long his e-butler reminded him to sip his water bottle, to counter the dehydration that his body could no longer feel. To cap it all, and the undisputed chief of everyone's bitch list, were the visits to the disposal utility chamber. It wasn't just politics that hadn't made much progress over 350 years. Taking a dump in space still involved a disturbing arrangement of straps and suction pumps. At least having a pee was relatively straightforward. That's if you were a man. The women on board had all undergone a little cellular reprofiling procedure to make suction tube use more convenient and less prone to slippage. It was a supreme test of character to ignore that during sex. Half a light year out from Dyson Alpha, the Conway came to a halt, though she remained inside the wormhole. The St. Asaph and the Langhorn moved up beside her. CST had solved the communications problem for ships in hyperdrive by using modulated pulses of the Heis radar function. Given the difficulty involved in producing a Heis pulse within the wormhole generator, the process was still somewhat crude. It certainly wasn't a directional signal. They were broadcasting to anyone in range, and it couldn't carry anything like the amount of data traffic a microwave beam could. But voice traffic was relatively easy to achieve.
Wilson drifted into the bridge compartment and secured himself in one of the acceleration couches. On either side of the couch, screens and hologram portals unfolded from their pedestals.
He studied the displays and asked Anna to sweep around with the Heis radar.
"Give it to a quarter light-year radius," he told her.
"Aye, sir," she replied from her own couch. She was serving as his executive officer for the flight and was very conscious of everyone knowing about their relationship. It made her a stickler for protocol and efficiency, constantly proving to the crew she'd won the position on merit alone. More than one had privately asked Wilson if he could make her ease off the tight-ass routine. From that point of view, he was rather looking forward to the flight ending himself. Freefall really wasn't everything the spaceflight romantics claimed. More than one of his bruises had been obtained inside their cabin. The Heis radar scan showed they were surrounded by clear space. There was no trace of anything under acceleration. His E-butler opened a channel to the other two scout ships, encrypting the transmission.
"Oscar, what have you got?" he asked.
"Nothing in sight," the captain of the Saint Asaph replied. "I guess they've stopped sending ships away from their own star. At least in this direction."
"Looks that way. Antonia, have you got anything?"
"Not a damn thing," Antonia Clark said from the bridge of the Langhan. "It's clean out here."
"All right, we'll proceed as agreed. Antonia, tag along with us until we're 10 AUs from the old barrier location. Stay in hyperspace and gather as much information as you can. Any hostile activity directed at us or you, and you are to get straight back to the Commonwealth."
"Understood." During the mission planning sessions back on Anshun, she had spent days arguing that her scout ship should be the one accompanying the Conway, but there was no trace of resentment in her voice now.
"Tuli, take us in," Wilson ordered. "Anna, sensors on passive mode, please."
"Already switched over, sir."
Wilson tried not to roll his eyes. The scout ships closed on Dyson Alpha. Their mission profile was simple enough. Conway and St. Asaph were to enter the inner system, scanning for any sign of wormhole activity. If they found one, they were to approach the source, drop out of hyperspace, and attempt to open communications. If there was no sign of the Dyson aliens experimenting with wormholes, they would fly to Alpha Major and try to open communications there. They were still a quarter of a light year out from the star when Anna said, "We're registering quantum fluctuations consistent with wormhole activity."
"From this far out?" Tunde Sutton queried.
"Yes. Whatever they've built, it's goddamn powerful." Morning Light Mountain began working on the problem as soon as its new Bose memories had revealed the theory and practical application of wormholes. It took just a few hundred immotile units to determine and quantify the fundamental principles, assisted by the Bose memory's basic knowledge of human physics and mathematics. The equations fitted easily enough into its own understanding of quantum physics, simply extending the knowledge in a fashion it wouldn't necessarily have thought of for itself. After that came the more challenging task of designing the hardware. Of that, the Bose memories had little information. After a month, during which over 1,000 immotile units had combined to analyze the new problem, and several advanced industrial manufacturing areas had been switched to producing components for the project, the first crude wormhole generator was up and running. Morning Light Mountain used it to open a small communications linkage to its biggest settlement at the large gas giant. There, Morning Light Mountain 23,957, which supervised the settlement, was connected directly back into the original immotile group in real time. Over the next few weeks, a series of small wormholes were opened to Morning Light Mountain's other settlements, joining more and more remote subsidiaries to the main group cluster of immotiles back on the home world, meshing them all together into a single gigantic grouping. At this point, All the spaceship production facilities Morning Light Mountain possessed across the star system were switched to manufacturing components for larger wormhole generators. As more and more wormholes were opened, linking planets, moonlets, and distant asteroid settlements, the spaceships became redundant. It dismantled them and incorporated their resources into the new transport system. New power stations were deployed around the sun, vast rotating structures protected by force fields that siphoned up the energy and transferred it, via wormhole, to the second gas giant where the greatest wormhole of all was being constructed, the one that would reach across interstellar space. It took the full mental capacity of 12,000 immotile brains to govern the interstellar wormhole. There were so many components to supervise, so many intricate applications of energy to control within the machinery. Morning Light Mountain amalgamated the immotile specifically to form the command group. They had no other function. They didn't take part in Morning Light Mountain's unified thought processes. Even then, with so much brain power devoted to the device's operation, it had to use more electronic processors than it ever had before to maintain the ancillary equipment. The interstellar wormhole had been operating for 3 weeks when several supplementary orbiting quantum wave detectors picked up the distortion points of approaching starships. They were smaller than the previous human starship, the Second Chance, but they were flying from the direction of the Commonwealth. They were also a lot faster. Ships, mission. Explain.
I don't know for certain. I expect a further attempt to establish communication. They'll certainly want to know what happened to me and Verbicky.
Confrontation probability. Extrapolate.
They don't want to fight. The ships will be heavily shielded, though. They saw several ship battles while they were here before. They'll know what level of defense they need this time.
Response. Explain.
Oh, well, with my great tactical expertise.
Tactical knowledge. Memory.
There was none. The Bose memories were lying. No, not lying, being sarcastic.
Sarcasm. Explain.
It's a human personality trait, culturally related. You either got it or you don't. I often used it to swat uppity students. I don't think it applies to your culture. You're more likely to use a nuke.
Not for the first time, Morning Light Mountain considered simply erasing the Bose memories. It often considered the alien thoughts to be a form of insanity.
Despite them being securely caged within a single immotile unit, there was noticeable leakage. Strange ideas and concepts often occurred these days, a different way of looking at things. After all, there was, it had to concede, a certain illogicality about releasing so much pollution across its homeworld, allowing so many motiles, parts of itself, to die in sickening fashion from disease and poison. It was killing itself for the now, not planning properly for tomorrow. It wasn't sure how the notion of sickening had crept into its thoughts. Such innovative thoughts might lead it into becoming alien prime, contaminated from within. Though it knew its prime rationality was still dominant, after all, it was a misapplication of resources to let so many motiles waste away. So for now it tolerated the Bose memories, knowing that soon it would no longer require them. The three human starships slowed their approach, then flew forward again. One came to a halt just beyond where the barrier used to be, remaining within the wormhole it was generating. The other two headed in for the second gas giant, where Morning Light Mountain had built the interstellar wormhole. It began to prepare nearby ships for interception. One of the human ships emerged from its wormhole amid a burst of blue radiation. It was 5 million kilometers from the interstellar wormhole. Electromagnetic beams swept out, probing space around it, while its wormhole generator emitted pulses of distortion, which the Bose memories identified as HICE radar. High cohesion force fields enveloped the human ship, deflecting most of Morning Light Mountain's sensor scans. They would be tough to break, it acknowledged, but not impossible. 16 ships were dispatched at high acceleration to interdict the enemy. Within seconds of their fusion drives coming on, the human ship directed microwave and laser beams toward them. This time, Morning Light Mountain understood the binary pulses, the simple mathematical constants, pixel matrices with basic images and symbols, periodic tables. It directed a communications maser back at the human ship. The Bose memories were marshaled to initiate contact, appropriate speech sequences selected.
"Hi, guys. It's Dudley Bose calling home. You took your sweet time getting back here, didn't you? But by God, I am sure glad to see you."
The human lasers switched off. A single microwave beam remained focused on the ship that had sent the message.
"Dudley, this is Commander Keim. How... are you all right? Jesus, Dudley, we never hoped for so much."
The voice was distorted by what the Bose memories identified as emotions of incredulity and hope.
"I made it, Captain. I'm okay. And I've got a whole load of new friends with me just waiting to meet you. Should be able to rendezvous with you in a little while."
"Dudley, are you on the ship that's sending your signal?"
"Sure am. How about that for coincidence? I've been out here for months helping the Primes with their wormhole."
"Dudley, that ship's under 10G acceleration."
The voice had changed. Morning Light Mountain's Bose memories identified it as puzzled.
"Yeah, God, don't I know it. It's hell on my spine."
"You can slow down," Wilson Keim said. "We're not going anywhere."
"Right, sure. I'll tell the captain."
Morning Light Mountain reduced the acceleration on its interdiction squadron to 3Gs. It didn't want to scare the humans off. Another new concept. So many since the barrier had fallen.
"Where's Emmanuel, Dudley?
Is she there with you?"
"No, she's back on the homeworld. Dead. Run, you dumb fuck. Run. They killed us. They'll kill all of us. It's inhuman. Run, you motherfuck."
Morning Light Mountain wanted to scream in pure fury as the betraying corruption burned through its consciousness. Its mind crushed the Bose memories as they blossomed out of the immotile brain where they had been stored, pummeling them back under control. Crushing them, eradicating them from existence. Demented, defiant human laughter echoed around inside the giant building that housed the central immotile grouping of Morning Light Mountain, the core of its existence, the memory of laughter, mocking as it faded.
Wilson stared, aghast, at the speaker that just a minute earlier had delivered a joy that had brought him close to tears. The shouts lingered in the deadly silence that filled the bridge. He'd known, deep down inside, from the moment the Dudley voice claimed to be on a ship doing 10 Gs and speaking as calmly as if they were sitting at a bar with a couple of drinks. If it's too good to be true, it probably is.
"The alien ships have started accelerating again," Anna called. 8 Gs.
9.
"Tuli, take us out of here now," Wilson ordered.
Deja vu plucked at him, almost comforting in its horrifying familiarity.
"Oscar, Antonia, scatter pattern 1. You heard the man. Run for it."
The screens showing visual spectrum images of space outside began to glow blue, as if they'd glided into a patch of planetary sky. Tuli sent the Conway streaking out of the Dyson system at half a light year an hour.
"God damn it, what happened?" Anna said. "What was that talking to us?"
"Whatever was left of Dudley Bose," Wilson said grimly. "Damn it, I always thought bad of him."
"Any sign of pursuit?"
"Nothing chasing us in hyperspace, Captain," Tundi said. "The Saint Asaph and Langhorne are ahead of us and spreading out."
Wilson studied the displays around his couch, breathing deeply to try to calm his racing heart. He watched the other two scout ships diving wide into the depths of interstellar space, making it difficult for any potential enemy to chase all of them. A pitiful maneuver, really. If the aliens had built FTL starships, they could send 1,000 after each of us. "We were out of hyperspace for 6.25 minutes, Anna said as the bridge crew started to relax. "Our mission time out here just keeps getting shorter, and we still have no idea what they look like." Wilson gave his e-butler some instructions, and it folded back one of the display screens around his couch. He turned to look at Tundi Sutton.
"What did our sensors collect?"
"Almost nothing, Captain," the physicist said glumly. "We weren't there long enough to obtain any decent imagery."
"What about that giant wormhole?"
"Ah, yes."
Tundi seemed curiously reticent to say anything.
"You know, we've never attempted to build anything on such a scale, and the amount of quantum activity we did manage to detect
indicated a considerable number of wormholes have been opened within the Dyson system. All of them were significantly smaller than the one above the outer gas giant. It confirms our previous conclusions about their industrial capabilities. A year and a half ago, they didn't have one wormhole generator. Just how big was that one above the gas giant?
Tandy began to call up Heiss radar records, concentrating on the outermost gas giant with its three large moons, and superimposing what little visual imagery they'd snatched. He focused the image on the third moon, orbiting 790,000 kilometers above the turbulent equatorial storm clouds. It was a rocky planetoid, with half of its fractured surface covered in ice sheets, averaging 5 kilometers thick. Hundreds of force field domes had encased nearly a quarter of the total surface area. Fusion drive ships clouded space around it, forming a bright ring 250 kilometers above the equator. From that, a sparkling river of blue-white plasma stretched across to the moon's outermost Lagrange point, 15,000 kilometers away. The aliens had stationed the wormhole at the center of the gravitational null point, where it kept its position with a minimum of thruster usage. There was no visual data. The generator structure itself was very dark, although it showed as a gleaming crimson spark in infrared. Heiss radar revealed a toroid, with a central aperture measuring 2.5 kilometers across. Ships were flying into the center at the rate of 1 every 5 or 6 minutes. Large ships.
Son of a bitch, Wilson murmured. Is there any way of telling where that leads?
No, sir, Tandy said. But judging by the strength of its quantum distortion, I'd say several hundred light years. Where they get that much power from, I don't know. There's no corresponding neutrino emissions which would indicate fusion sources.
Have they reached inside the Commonwealth? Wilson asked sharply.
It won't extend that far. 400 light years, possibly. Maybe 5.
Wilson wanted to feel relief. It should have been there, knowing the aliens hadn't reached home behind him. But the sensation eluded him completely. What they'd seen was too worrying. Even for a civilization this size, the giant wormhole was too obviously a crash project, an act of desperation. He was sure he knew where it would take them eventually. The why of it, though, he couldn't understand. What could they possibly want with the Commonwealth? It was an astonishing landscape. Nothing you couldn't find on any H-congruous world, but scaled up 20%. Higher mountains, deeper valleys. Wider rivers, broader plains. Even the sky seemed bigger, though that might have been due to the absence of clouds during the long daytime. All of which made Ozzy worry about what kind of animals they might encounter. Rats the size of dogs? Dogs the size of horses? What might the elephants be like, or the dinosaurs? They'd been here for 8 days now, though, and hadn't seen so much as a gnat so far. The plants didn't quite match up to the scenery. They were all bland. Grass that was like a sheet of moss. Bushes that were globes with slender little leaves that were woven together so tightly that from a distance they looked like a single membrane. Trees that had a simple conical symmetry with dark green finger-sized leaves. Botany at least wasn't adventurous here. In fact, he hadn't seen a single flower since they arrived. Maybe evolution had bypassed the whole concept of pollination, or maybe there were no insects to pollinate. That made Tochi the most colorful thing on the planet. The big alien had recovered quickly from its frostbite as they wandered along the paths after escaping the ice citadel planet. Its rubbery locomotion ridges had almost completely healed up now, after weeks of sliding along through temperate grassland and loamy forest floors. Of the three planets they'd progressed through, one of the paths had been in a tropical zone. Tochi had really liked that. The little shriveled fronds sprouting from wrinkles in its brown hide had sprouted into colorful life. They now resembled feathery ferns, whose vivid pigmentation acted like a silky flowing cloak. Ripples of scarlet, tangerine, turquoise, and emerald swayed along its body with every motion and gust of wind.
"It looks like a furry rainbow," Orion had said when the fronds began to grow again.
The boy was a great deal happier now as well. A lot of his former chirpy confidence had returned, strengthening with every additional step they put between themselves and the ice citadel.
Ozzy was half expecting him to start asking, "Are we there yet?" which, given their circumstances, was just about impossible to answer. The sylphan paths had been reasonably obvious on the worlds they'd visited so far, and the little friendship pendant had helped a couple of times when Ozzy was uncertain. But to date, they'd found themselves in areas where the forests were close together, with just a couple of valleys or hills separating their boundaries. This big world was different. They'd emerged from a tree line to see a vast undulating plain stretching away ahead of them. The forest behind filled a V-shaped valley. There was only the one path through it, leading straight out alongside the swift stream that gushed down the valley floor. So they simply carried on walking, keeping close to the stream. It was one of the many tributaries feeding the river that cut across the plain. In 5 days' continuous hiking, they'd found plenty of similar woods hugging steep valleys, not one of which had a sylphan path leading out. The trees did have edible fruit, globes the size of melons with a fibrous pap that tasted similar to bland apples. That seemed to be a constant on the worlds linked by sylphan paths. Nothing edible had a strong taste. Orion would knock the fruit down with a big stick, sometimes with Tochi holding him aloft in its tentacles so he could reach the ones dangling on higher branches. Every time Ozzy watched the laughing boy flailing away at the fruit, he would think of curries and chili burgers. The river was leading them toward a range of snow-capped mountains that marked the end of the plain. As they neared the foothills, the pervasive mat of grass thinned out, leaving stretches of thin sandy soil exposed to the air. Soon only the broad ravine through which the river flowed held any greenery. They picked their way along the boulder-strewn sides, testing carefully for boggy ground. Ozzy and Orion were both carrying heavy rucksacks, while Tochi had a pair of big old panniers slung over its back. As the ravine started to slope down, the river flow quickened, foaming around stones sticking up from its bed. "Still wish we'd made a boat?" Orion asked cheerfully as they passed one set of boulders that were sending out great spumes. It was something Ozzy had suggested earlier, at around the third forest they'd examined for paths. While it made sense, his diamond-tipped blade wasn't the ideal tool for cutting and trimming that many trees. In any case, they hadn't had any rope to lash even a crude raft together. At the time, he'd just wanted to get off the plain. Days spent under the silent expanse of sky were bad enough, but at night he hurried into the tent, unnerved by the emptiness around them. Some deep, buried intuition was wary of the planet. "I've been down worse rapids than these," Ozzy told him defensively. After half a day trailing along the side of the ravine, it turned sharply and opened out into a massive canyon. The river surged forward and fell away down a series of steep steps, each taller than the last, ending with a waterfall that thundered over a cliff 300 yards high. After so many days immersed in the deep silence that blanketed the empty plain, the roar from the cascading water was shocking. "So now what?" Orion asked. He was facing the giant canyon that carried the water away beyond the falls. It seemed to slice clean through the mountain range. "There's no way off this world behind us," Ozzy said, thinking out loud. "We either keep following the river or look for some other way around the mountains." He brought out a very tatty sheet of parchment. His last charcoal stump was down to a small nub, so finding the sharpest edge he wrote, "I think we should go on. This seems to be the path."
"I agree," Tochi's forward eye segment flashed. All throughout the long afternoon they picked their way down the side of the falls. With the rocks slick from all the spray, they moved slowly and carefully. If there was to be any kind of accident here, the chances of help were effectively zero. Traveling alone had instilled a sense of caution into them. Even Orion didn't make any complaint about how long the descent was taking. Tochi took the lead. With its locomotion ridges, it was easily the most agile of the three of them on the precarious gradient. The sun had long vanished behind the canyon walls when they reached the floor. According to Ozzy's virtual vision timer, they still had another 2 hours of full daylight. He took his sunglasses off to squint at the bright, naked rocks all around. Somewhat inevitably, the sun here was bright enough to make them wear the protective glasses all day long. The mist thrown out by the waterfall had fooled him for a moment,
producing a pocket of cool, humid air around the base of the falls. But even out of the direct sunlight, he was better off with the glasses on. They walked past the deep rock pool formed by the churning impact of the waterfall, and carried on to where the river resumed its calm flow, gurgling across the sandy pebbles that made up its broad bed. He stood on the bank to take in the view. The near-vertical walls of iron-red rock on both sides were about two-thirds of a mile high, and as the canyon curved gently around to the east in front of him, it looked as though they were growing progressively taller. At the widest, the canyon floor stretched about 5 miles wide. Nothing grew within the canyon, no grass or scrub. The floor was shingle and sand, all the same sandstone red as the walls. He could see great conic mounds of jagged rock piled up all along the base of each cliff, where giant sections had broken off far above to crash down into pulverized scree. One of Tochi's manipulator flesh arms poked up, a very human gesture it had developed to attract their attention. When Ozzy turned to check the alien, mauve patterns were flickering in its forward eye segment.
Something at the first curve, possibly a tree.
Ozzy ordered his retinal implants to zoom in. The air was shimmering from the heat of the rocks and the air, but some dark smudge was visible beside the river just as it turned out of sight.
Could be, he wrote.
They started off along the canyon, and almost immediately came across the ancient fire. It was a simple circle of stones, their inner sides blackened. The ash had blown away long ago, leaving just darkened sand inside.
Look!
Orion cried and ran off. He stopped a few yards past the fire circle and picked something out of the sand. His smile was victorious as he held up his trophy.
Son of a bitch,
Ozzy grunted. The boy had found a soda can. Its coloring had bleached badly over the years, but the familiar logo was easily visible.
Are we on Earth?
The boy asked excitedly.
Sorry, man. No way. This must be somewhere in the Commonwealth, though. We even had soda on Silvergalda.
Ozzy scratched at his large, fuzzy beard.
I think it's just litter. You know what people are like, the biggest hooligans in the universe. But hey, it proves we're on the right path.
He didn't want to crush the boy's fragile hope. Orion gave the can a vexed look and chucked it back onto the sand. An hour later they stopped and set up camp for the night. Ozzy and Orion pitched their tent on a small rise, several hundred yards from the river, then set about washing socks and shirts before the last of the light vanished. Ozzy would have loved to dive right in and give himself a decent clean, but even though they still hadn't seen a single living creature on this world, he just couldn't quite bring himself to trust the water. Too many late student nights with a pizza, a couple of six-packs, some grass, and a bad sci-fi DVD. God only knew what lurked along the bottom of the river. Maybe nothing, but he certainly wasn't going to wind up with alien eggs hatching out of his ass, thank you. All of a sudden, the long evening spent lazing around in the ice citadel's hot pools didn't seem so bad after all. They were making their way back up to the tent when Orion stopped and said,
"There's a light."
Ozzy looked down the canyon where the boy was pointing. A tiny golden spark was shining a long way downstream. He wasn't even sure it was on their side of the river. His retinal insert zoom function couldn't get a clear image. No matter how high the magnification, it remained a flickering blur. When he switched to infrared, it barely registered. Not a fire, then. Probably someone else walking the path, he said with a reassurance he didn't feel. Tochi had seen the light as well, though the alien's eye was unable to focus on it either. They kept watching it as they ate their evening meal of tasteless fruit and cold water, but it wasn't moving. Ozzy and Tochi took turns through the night to make sure it didn't come any closer. It was Ozzy who got the midnight to morning shift. He sat on a flattish rock beside the tent, dressed in his cords and checked shirt, with his sleeping bag wrapped around his shoulders like a blanket. The river murmured away quietly, and occasionally he heard a low rattling wheeze from Tochi that he classed as alien snoring. Other than that, there was only the deep silence you would always associate with this world. A brilliant multitude of stars shone down through the cloudless, moonless sky. He'd never seen so many before, not even when he went world-walking on new Commonwealth worlds before they were contaminated by civilization's light pollution. One hazy nebula, 4 or 5 times larger than Earth's moon, kept drawing his attention. It bent sharply at one end, with a reddish spike protruding away from the main haze. He couldn't remember any astronomical phenomenon remotely like that being close to the Commonwealth. The Devil's Tail, he named it. Shame nobody would ever know. In the wilderness hours just before dawn, he heard voices. He sat up immediately, unsure if he'd been drifting off to sleep. They could have been the start of some dream, but they weren't human voices, or at least not one speaking any language he recognized. The spark of light hadn't moved. He switched his inserts to infrared and slowly scanned around, turning a complete circle. The voices came again. Definitely not a dream. They swept past him, causing him to turn so fast he almost lost his balance, several of them babbling together. A non-human language. They sounded urgent, frightened. But it was only the sound. Nothing moved in the canyon. Nothing physical. Almost, he asked, "Who's there?" Except that really was the stuff of late-night horror DVDs. Dumb. Whispers slithered past him. Somebody, something, whimpering into the distance. Ozzy dropped the sleeping bag and held his arms out, concentrating on his hands, trying to feel air being stirred, the tiniest hint of movement. He closed his eyes, knowing that a visual sense was no longer any use to him. Listening, stroking the air. The sound came again, conjuring up the old phrase, voices on the wind. He heard what was said, and repeated it back to them softly. It made no difference. They carried on past him, paying no attention. That was how Orion found him as the first wave of pale dawn lifted over the canyon wall, standing motionless with arms outstretched like some religious statue, mumbling words in an alien tongue. The boy clambered out of the tent, rubbing sleep from his eyes as he yawned. "What are you doing?" Ozzy sighed and let his arms down with a suspiciously yoga-like sweeping motion. He gave Orion an inscrutable grin. "Talking to the ghosts." Orion's head whipped around, trying to find anything. "Are you all right? Did you hit your head or something?" "Not since that bar on Lothian, and that was years ago. This world is haunted."
"Oh, come on, Ozzy, that's not funny. Not here. This whole planet is creepy."
"I know, man, I'm sorry. But I did hear something, like a bunch of people or aliens."
"A Sylphan?"
"No, I know their language. I don't know what these guys were saying, but you get a feel from the tone. They were sad or frightened. Maybe both."
"Hey, quit it. I don't like this."
"Yeah, I know. I think that's the point, man."
"The point of what?"
"Whatever I experienced." He frowned. "What did I experience? Except there's no such thing as ghosts. So, some kind of projection? Bit childish just to spook travelers. I mean, why not go the whole hog and put a white sheet over your head and jump out on them from behind a rock?"
"You said the Sylphan did have an afterlife,"
Orion said quietly. Ozzy gave him a thoughtful look. "You really do pay attention, don't you?"
"Sometimes."
The boy shrugged as he smirked. "Okay, then let's think about this. None of our electronics are working, so the ghosts can't be any kind of normal projection. Holograms, sound focus, that kind of crap. The Sylphon are active here, which implies it must be happening with their knowledge or consent."
"Unless it's them doing it," Orion said, suddenly excited. "There's nothing alive here. We haven't seen any animals or insects. Maybe this is their afterworld, where all the Sylphon ghosts live."
Ozzy grimaced and looked around the stark, massive canyon. "Somehow I think not. I'd expect something a little more impressive, but I could be wrong."
He finished up by looking along the canyon.
"You can't see the light anymore, either."
Tochi slithered up between them, raising a limb of manipulator flesh.
"What's happening?"
the pattern in its eyes asked.
"This should test our vocabulary," Ozzy muttered.
By mid-morning they could see the black pillars ahead were indeed trees. Even by this world's standards they were giants, perfect thin cones reaching over 150 yards into the air. They had been planted in a double row, half a mile to the side of the river, forming an impressive avenue down the canyon.
"Somebody does live here, then," Orion said as they drew near to the start of the avenue.
"Looks that way." Ozzy tilted his head back to see the tops of the first trees.
"You know, either they're made out of a wood harder than steel, or there's hardly any wind here, ever."
"Is that important?"
"I don't know, dude, but it's definitely a spike on the Bizarro graph."
Orion giggled. "This whole place is a spike."
"I'm not arguing."
An hour later, when the canyon walls straightened out, allowing them to see ahead for miles, they made out a group of figures walking along the avenue ahead of them. Seven people, a long way in front, moving at a steady pace.
"Bipeds like you," Tochi's pattern declared. "They made the light last night."
"Could have done," Ozzy wrote.
"They move slower than us. We can catch them today if we increase speed."
Ozzy had been thinking the same thing. Of course, if he really wanted to attract their attention, there were several flares left in his backpack, though he didn't want to use them for anything less than a genuine emergency. And the group in front would have to be looking around at the right moment. He was slightly surprised they hadn't seen them already, especially given the way Tochi's fabulous technicolor coating clashed against the drab ironstone. "Speeding up will be hard on us. We will reach them eventually."
"Agreed."
In the afternoon, when they'd been walking down the empty avenue for several hours, they came to the first ruin. A small stream wriggled across the canyon, running from the base of the cliff wall down to the river, crossing through the avenue at right angles. At some time long ago, a simple curved stone bridge had carried the path over it. Now all that was left were the solid foundations on either side, sticking up from the dusty ground like a set of broken teeth. There were gentle grooves in the stonework, resembling the trails snakes left in sand. Ozzy couldn't tell if they were natural wind erosions or ancient carvings. Thinking about the trees again, he suspected carvings. How long it would take for them to wear away like this, he had no idea. Centuries, at least.
"I wish my arrays were working," he sighed. "They could carbon date this right down to the afternoon it was built."
"Really?"
"Pretty close, yeah." It was always slightly unnerving how little Orion knew about technology. He had to be careful what he said, especially jokingly, which wasn't an Aussie trait, but the boy tended to take everything he said as gospel. They splashed through the little stream and carried on walking. Ozzy resisted the urge to carve his name into the bridge. He was mildly surprised that no one else had, especially the guys who'd left the soda can. By the time they made camp, they'd passed another ruined bridge, as well as a big circular depression in the ground, whose edges were made from tight-fitting stone blocks. Neither archaeological remnant provided any clue as to what kind of creatures had built them. A bridge was a pretty basic design for any species, as were sturdy foundations, which is what Ozzy suspected the circle to be. Through the day, they'd managed to close the distance on the group of travelers in front of them to about a mile. Once they got the tent up, the gold light became visible in the gathering darkness.
"That's just about where they are," Orion said. "You should fire a flare, Ozzy. There's no way they can't see it now."
Ozzy gazed at the steady point of light. "They know we're here. If they don't want to talk to us, there's no sense in trying to force them."
Orion nodded cheerfully and cut into one of the big fruits.
"I get that about people now. You can't rush somebody who doesn't want to be rushed, right?"
"You're learning."
"So I let the girl set the pace."
"Yes, that's right."
"And she'll always find a way to tell me when she's ready to go to bed. You're sure about that?"
Yeah.
Ozzy was beginning to dread evenings around the campfire. The boy did have an amazingly one-track mind.
"But look, man, it's going to be subtle. You've got to be alert and in tune."
"Like, how do you mean?"
"Okay, if she's happy for the date to go on as long as you want, that's a good sign."
"I thought you said don't try to get her to bed on the first date."
Yes, that's right. But this is the second date, or later."
"Okay."
So it goes on all night. Do I ask them home, or will they ask me?
I don't know, man. It depends on the girl, okay?
Use your judgment.
But, Ozzy, I haven't got any, that's why I ask you.
Want another line to use? He'd found that was always a good way to make Orion stop, although the cost to his own dignity was always painfully high.
Yeah.
All right. But you've got to have a ton of self-confidence for this one, okay? Show no fear.
Is it me, or do you always look this good?
Maybe, Orion said dubiously. But you'd have to have a good follow-up line.
Hey, I'm just showing you how to open the door. Once you're in the room, you're on your own.
The voices returned in the deep of night. This time they were slightly louder, occurring more frequently. Orion woke with a start as one set of voices passed right beside the tent. Ozzy was already sitting up in his sleeping bag, listening to what was spoken and the way it was said.
It is ghosts, isn't it?
Orion said solemnly.
Kind of looks that way, yeah. You scared, man?
Ozzy, it's ghosts.
Right. Well, I'm scared, just in case you wanted to know.
He wriggled out of his sleeping bag and unzipped the tent. The night air was alive with sound. Hundreds of voices that swirled chaotically around their little camp. He walked out into their midst, turning into daylight. His feet were standing on a lush carpet of blue-green grass that covered the canyon floor, along with trees and thick bushes. The avenue of trees had been replaced by a road built from stone cobbles. Strange five-legged bovine animals pulled wooden carts along it, piled high with barrels and some local version of hay. The drivers were aliens that looked like pear-shaped jellyfish, with hundreds of slender tendrils emerging from their lower half, serving as both legs and arms. Individually weak, the wax-white tendrils would twine together to produce a stronger limb for whatever use was required. Dozens of them were sliding along the road, the tips of their tendrils twisting and scrabbling like impaled worms to move them forward. They called to each other in low, gurgling voices. One of the carts was heading straight for Ozzy. He waved his arms frantically.
Hey, watch what...
The driver obviously couldn't see him or the tent, or Orion standing at his side. He grabbed a frozen Orion and hauled him aside, falling off the side of the road, into nighttime.
Fuck me, Ozzy grunted.
He raised his head and looked around. Nothing had changed. Stars glittered in the night sky, casting a faint illumination. The avenue of trees stood impassively along the side of the quiet river, marking the course of the old road.
Wow,
Orion gushed.
Cool.
Huh? Starlight showed the boy's wide smile.
Don't you get it? This canyon is a time machine, like the sylphen paths are wormholes. How smooth is that?
That was just an image, man, Ozzy said, somewhat stiffly as he clambered back to his feet, brushing sand off his shorts. It's showing us what used to be here.
I smelled them, Ozzy. It was like vinegar. That was real, not an image. We were there in the past. Anyway, you thought we were there. Why else did you dive for cover?
I was surprised, that's all. And I didn't know what level the image extended to. People have gotten themselves hurt in TSI, you know, man.
You were scared.
Orion flung his arms wide, laughing wildly at the canyon wall.
Hey, you scared Ozzy. Bad time machine.
This is not... Ozzy got a grip, although he'd noticed the smell too. He looked along the avenue, checking on the golden light from the other group. It was still there, unmoving. The ghost voices had come back, slipping sinuously through the air.
Damn, this place is weird.
Ozzy! Orion gasped. One of the jellyfish aliens was slipping past them, wrapped in its own little nimbus of daylight. Tochi pushed its ice whale fur blanket aside, rearing up on its locomotion ridges in shock as the seemingly solid apparition glided along.
What was that?
Tochi's eye patterns were shining so brightly, Ozzy half expected Orion to see them. He shrugged. They certainly didn't have anything like the vocabulary for time-traveling spooks. When he glanced around, the lone jelly alien had gone.
I think we'd better get off the avenue.
It's only a few hours to dawn. We should try and get some rest.
Oh, Ozzy, this is wonderful. We might wind up finishing this journey before we started. I could go back to Silvergaldy and stop my parents from ever leaving.
Look, man, I know you think a time machine is a groovy thing, but take it from me. There are quantum fundamentals that prevent it from happening, okay? I know what this looks like, but it isn't real.
Orion was about to answer when a small mechanical car appeared, with two jelly aliens sitting in the cab. Smoke and steam belched furiously from stumpy chimneys in its rear. The boy drew in a sharp breath and swayed backward.
I think maybe you're right. We'll get run over here.
Ozzy was sorely tempted to just stand there and let one of the apparitions glide right through him, but they looked so damn real. The three of them gathered up their packs and hurried away from the avenue. As soon as they were outside the line of trees, the voices faded away, although they never fell completely quiet. Ozzy and Orion sat against a boulder, wrapping their sleeping bags around them. Every now and then, opalescent light would burst out of the avenue, silhouetting the bottom of the trees as the long dead aliens walked their old road. After a while, Ozzy stopped trying to figure it out and closed his eyes.
I've got a theory, Orion said eagerly as they munched on their tasteless breakfast. I think Sarah walked down this canyon. That's why she's still alive after so long. The canyon brought her into the future.
It's not a time machine, Ozzy said for what must have been the tenth time. Time cannot flow backward. You cannot move back through time.
It is a one-way current, period, dude. She moved forward.
Okay, not so difficult. Even we can do that.
Can we?
Orion was fascinated.
Well, in theory, yeah. The internal structure of a wormhole can be modified, so its time frame is desynchronized. In other words, you go in at one end, and a week later you come out of the other. But for you, only a second has elapsed. I'm pretty sure that's what's been happening on the Sylphan paths. It certainly makes sense, especially when you think of people like Sarah.
Have you done it with your wormholes?
No. It's very complicated. We don't have the technology to match the math yet. He grunted in disapproval. Maybe we will by the time you and I make it back.
That morning they walked parallel to the avenue of trees, keeping a good 300 yards distant. They kept noticing movement on the path. It was almost subliminal. Shadows that flickered between the trunks, vanishing when any attention was focused on them. The apparitions certainly weren't as vivid during the day. A couple of hours after they started, they realized they were finally catching up with the other travelers. The group had remained in the avenue. They now looked as if they were walking into a strong wind, leaning forward to push on doggedly, their cloaks streaming out behind them.
They're Sylphan, Orion said. I'm sure they are.
Ozzy zoomed in. The boy was right. Another spike, he muttered.
Are we going to talk to them?
I don't know.
Ozzy was torn. They hadn't seen any sentient creatures since leaving the Ice Citadel world. On the other hand, the Sylphan never made a lot of sense at the best of times. Let's see where they're at when we catch up with them. As they hiked on, a big gap slowly became visible in the avenue up ahead. They could see the trees carry on the other side. But for over a couple of miles, the canyon floor was empty.
I can't see any fallen trees, Ozzy said as he scanned the ground. Looks like the people who planted them wanted a break.
Is there anything built there? Orion asked.
Can't see any ruins.
They were catching up quite quickly with the Sylphan group now. Ozzy estimated they should be level with them just before the gap in the avenue. The dark, spectral shadows still flitted along the path, accompanied by the occasional mournful gabble. He was fairly sure it was the same language he'd heard the jelly aliens use when he'd been inside the projection. When they were only a few hundred yards behind the Sylphan, Tochi raised a tentacle.
That is not natural, its patterns claimed.
The tentacle was now pointing directly at the canyon wall in the long gap. Ozzy studied the rock, trying to see what Tochi was looking at. Some of the vertical crevices did look a bit too regular. He shifted his sense of scale and gasped with astonishment. The edifice was so large, he hadn't recognized it for what it was.
Millennia ago, the cliff had been carved with the profiles of the jelly aliens. There were two of them, a mile apart. Each one must have measured nearly half a mile high. Entropy had slowly gnawed away at them, rockfalls and slippage pulling away huge segments, distorting the outline. The piles of scree along the cliff base below them were exceptionally tall. But even after nature's vandalism, the shapes were still distinct enough for him to identify. Between them was a palace that used to stretch nearly the entire height of the cliff. He assumed it was a palace, though it could easily have been a vertical city or temple, possibly even a fortress. The architecture was vaguely reminiscent of Bavarian castles he'd seen built to crest rugged alpine peaks, although in this case, one built by termites. It was almost as though the curving turrets and half-moon balconies had grown out of the rock, not that there were many of them left, and none were complete. Overall, there was even less of it remaining than the giant statues that guarded it on either side. Flying buttresses protruded from the sheer surface, curving upward to end in jagged spikes, as whatever structure they once supported had snapped off, to plummet onto the vast foothills of rubble strewn along the base. Stairways and pathways zigzagged all over the exposed surface. Hundreds of rooms were visible as small cavities where their front halves were missing. Thousands of open black caves showed where passages tunneled back into the rock, linking interior rooms and halls. "What happened here?" Orion asked. His voice verged on the reverential. Ozzy shook his head, for once humbled by the scale of the tragedy. It was profoundly disturbing that a species obviously so capable and intelligent could allow their civilization to fail in such a fashion. I think we should ask the Sylphan. As soon as they started to angle back toward the avenue, they discovered why the Sylphan were making such hard going. It wasn't the wind that pushed against them. The memories of the old road were growing stronger. All the past travelers who'd used the ancient highway were retracing their journey, each of them using the canyon at the same time. They lacked the solidity that the apparitions of last night had possessed, but they more than made up for that by the sheer weight of numbers. At first, Ozzy merely flinched as the phantoms flew toward him sporadically, bracing himself as they hit, only to find they'd passed right through him without any contact. Some of the aliens, the majority, were simple walkers. Others drove rickety carts or rode animals. A few were in mechanical contraptions. The density of the spectral travelers increased proportionally as they drew nearer to the avenue. With them came their noise, the cries of hundreds of aliens talking and shouting at once. And their numbers finally added up to a little gust of pressure. Ozzy put his head down as he headed into them. He felt something touch his wrist and jumped in shock. When he looked down, he saw Tochi's tentacle of manipulator flesh coiling around his hand. The alien was also taking hold of Orion's wrist. Linked together, the three of them pushed in farther toward the Sylphan. Inside the line of trees, the bygone aliens merged together into a single, blurred slipstream of color. Their voices became a single unending howl. It really was a gale pushing against them now. Ozzy leaned into it, thankful for Tochi's steadying grip. His shirt and sweater were flapping wildly against him. He set his face with grim determination and forced his feet to move forward. The Sylphan were easy enough to see, a knot of darkness amid the torrent of color and light and noise pouring through the avenue. As they forced their way closer, he realized that the Sylphan were all old. Their long hair was thin and gray. Deep creases lined their flat faces, etching dignity into their features. He'd never seen signs of aging among them before. Of course, he'd never seen Sylphan children either, assuming there were such things. But age had given them a distinction that humans normally lacked as their years advanced. And even now, as they pushed themselves against the road's history, their long limbs never faltered. "Greetings," Ozzy called in the Sylphan language. One of the Sylphan turned, his wide dark eyes regarding him with the curiosity of a grandmother who'd forgotten the name of her favorite grandchild.
"It's me, Ozzy. Remember me?"
"Never can we not remember, dearest Ozzy, least of all amid this place of remembrance. Joyful that we are to find you here where you sought to be."
"Sorry, but I never wanted to be here."
Her gay laughter seemed to calm the whooping of the ghosts.
"Demanding you were that all wonders should be shown and known in places far from home. How fast your mind skips and changes with your fickle mood. A delight and a sorrow burn behind your eyes with the beauty of twin stars forever dancing around the perfect circle. Are these wonders to you? I think they are times long gone. Hearken to the knowing, Ozzy, as you tread paths through lost worlds. Full with understanding you shall become to the delight of your stubborn self. Wonder begets not only the joy, but the sorrow. Both must be, for the other to live, for ultimately they are twined into the one. Here you come where few have been. So deep is your need, so loud is your song. Still we love you, though you are not ready to fall into the one circle of light and air, where the song will be sung to the end, be it bitter or be it sweet. This is the answer to the Dyson barrier. Tell me of the imprisoned stars. I would so much like to learn. So you will as you walk down this valley of death to the shadows that linger and mourn. You gotta be kidding, he muttered in English. You're quoting the Bible at me. The sylphan woman's long tongue shivered in the center of her mouth. Is this where I looked to be? Is this inside the prison around the stars? Do your paths reach through walls of darkness? Cast aside your numbers and your coarse voice, and learn how to sing, sweet Ozzy. Song is the destiny of all who live, who love to live. I don't understand, he groaned through clenched teeth. I don't know if this is the answer. What is this fucking place? He gave the sylphan a look of anguish, and switched back to their language. Why are you here in this dead valley? Why do you endure this? Here we come to complete our song. Small and frail we are, and searching for our place amid that which is to come. Long our journey has been. Bright has been the light shining upon us. Loud the songs we have had sung to us. Hard and soft has been the land upon which our feet have trod. Soon we shall walk no more. This is it. This is the end of the sylphan path. Will your feet end their walking in this valley? Ozzy, Orion called. Ozzy, the ghosts are going. Ozzy looked around. They'd reached the last two trees, and the pressure was fading rapidly. The ghosts were fading away, allowing the full rays of the sun to sweep down across the broken rock of the valley floor. As he looked around in bewilderment, their warbling voices dwindled to nothing. He was left stumbling forward, bracing himself against nothing. Stretching above him for the full height of the canyon wall was the ancient, crumbling alien palace city. The path we walk and love goes round and round, and thus it can never end, Ozzy, the sylphan woman said. She sounded profoundly sad, as if she was telling him about death. It begins when you begin. It ends as you end. And in between, what then? Is that when we sing? Walking the path, you hear many songs. Songs to treasure. Songs to fear. Come, Ozzy, come listen to the broken song of this world. Here lies the melody you desire, to walk farther amid the tangle of mystery that is all of us. The sylphan had joined hands. Now the tall woman held out her hand to him. Orion was giving him a nervous look. Tochi's eye patterns asked, What now? Tell our friend I don't know, Ozzy told Orion. But I'm going to find out. Ozzy? It'll be fine. He put his hand out to the sylphan woman. Her skin was warm and dry as her four fingers bent supplely around his hand. In an obscure way he found that comforting. Together they started walking toward the vertical ruins. At the foot of the huge pile of shattered stone was a featureless black globe. It was as high as a sylphan was tall. Ozzy wasn't sure if it actually rested on the ruddy sand or floated just above it. Now you will know this planet song, she said as they approached the sphere. All it used to sing comes from within its last memory. Ozzy almost hesitated.
Then he saw the planet floating at the center of the sphere. He peered forward like an eager child. It wasn't the image of the planet. It was a ghost, just like the aliens who haunted the roadway along the canyon. Long ago it had floated blissfully in space, known to the sylphan who walked their paths through its bucolic forests. Its inhabitants, the jelly-like aliens, built themselves a peaceful civilization, advancing their knowledge, as did most species. They had even begun to explore their solar system, sending crewed ships to land on planets and moons. Which was when the Imperial colonizers arrived. Vast starships plunged into the star system on fusion flames, curving into orbit around this quiet, happy world. They had taken decades to cross interstellar space, and were hungry for their prize, a new world on which to re-establish their old empire. The war of conquest was as short as it was futile. The planetary inhabitants resisted as best they could, modifying their instrument-carrying rockets to assault the huge invaders above their beautiful planet. Some damage was inflicted on the big ships, which goaded the imperialists into fierce retaliation. In the forests and glades below, the sylphon hurried down their paths to regain the peace and freedom denied to those whose home this was. But even the elfin folk, whose life was one of happiness and fey interest in the worlds they passed through, were troubled by the horrific violence erupting around them. In penance, they watched. Ozzy was shown the dark-armored starships sending their missiles and kinetic projectiles hurtling down onto the planet below. Explosions ripped through the sleeping clouds, distorting the world's air. Waves of destruction rolled out. Solid ground rippled like water. Oceans rose in rage. Towns and cities were blasted apart. Aliens died in the tens of thousands in the first few seconds. Ozzy knew them. He felt their death, their grief, their fear, their loss, their sorrow, their regret as their homes disintegrated, their bitterness as their children were torn apart before them. Every one of them was there for him to identify and experience. And the deaths multiplied as the Empire's weapons cast this world into smoking radioactive oblivion before the starships departed in search of new worlds, worlds easier to subdue. Ozzy fell back from the globe, curling up into a fetal ball as the tears flooded down his cheeks to stain the dead world's dry, sandy soil. He wept for hours as the terrible anguish of countless deaths soaked through him. He hated it as he had hated nothing in his life before. Hated what was done. Hated the blind stupidity of the imperialists. Hated the sylphon for standing by and doing nothing. Hated the waste of so much life. So much promise. Hated knowing what a better universe it could have been if only the quiet, simple aliens, whose world this once was, had survived and finally met the gaudy, flawed human race as the Commonwealth expanded. Hated that such a meeting of unalike minds would never happen. Late in the afternoon, when his tears had long since dried up, he stopped his pitiful, whimpering lament and rolled onto his back, blinking up at the cloudless sky. Orion and Tochi gazed down anxiously at him.
Ozzy,
Orion pleaded, his own face close to tears.
Please don't cry any more.
It's hard not to,
he croaked.
I was here.
I was with every one of them when they died.
He started to tremble again.
Ozzy, please.
He felt Orion's hand grasp his own, in desperate need of reassurance. A boy, lost. Light years from home, abandoned by his parents, on an adventure that had become a nightmare for too many months. The frail human touch was what he needed not to fall into that black infinity of horror. And how much of an irony was that, the super-independent Ozzy needing someone?
Okay,
Ozzy said weakly, and gripped the boy's hand roughly.
Okay. Give me a moment here, dude. Yeah.
He tried to sit up, only to find his body barely responding. Tochi's manipulator flesh slid under him, helping to shift him upright. He looked around at the canyon, almost fearful of what he would see.
Where are the sylphon?
I don't know, Orion said. They left ages ago.
Finally got something right. I'd kill the bastards if they'd stayed. Ozzy, what happened? What did you see?
He put a hand up to his forehead, surprised at how hot the skin was, as if he'd come down with a fever.
I saw what happened to this world.
Some aliens arrived in starships and
nuked it to shit.
Orion gazed around uncertainly.
Here? Yeah.
But a long time ago, I guess. He looked at the ruined palace city, feeling a fresh wave of sadness.
Why did they show that to you?
I don't know, man, I really don't. They thought it was what I wanted for my song.
Song, hell.
A dismissive grunt escaped from his mouth. I'd say we've got some serious translation problems here. Reckon I'm gonna sue someone in the cultural department when we get home for like $1 trillion. I'm never going to recover from this. Ozzy stopped, knowing just how true that was. But then I guess that's the whole point. It's a memory that belongs to the Sylphon. They're the ones who watched it all,
and they did nothing.
He scooped up some of the sandy soil, then let it trickle away through his fingers, mesmerized by the drifting grains.
This is for them. It's their grief, not mine. Not the people whose world this used to be.
It's about them. Nobody else knows or cares. Not anymore.
So what do we do now?
Ozzy eyed the black globe wearily.
Leave. There's nothing here for us.